Yeah, very good. So I hope you can all hear and see and everything. Nothing much to see, but as long as there's something to hear. And with some meditation groups, I love talking about meditation simply because it's a great joy, great peace. Somebody asked me today, a little kid, the question he got from school. He's going to a monastery today to visit, and his school asked, well, who was the Buddha? For about 6-year-old, how can you explain what a Buddha is? I mentioned to him that like a Buddha is like a symbol of wisdom, of seeing some truth. And it's not just the words, the truth, or the theories, or whatever. It's where it comes from. Now that's the most important part. And the meditation is training your mind so that where things come from is accurate, reliable. And the simile which I told the kid, and I asked his mother to do this evening, is actually to see if he can take him out in the evening to a nice lake on a calm evening. And when the evening is very peaceful and very still, and when you go out and see that lake, there's no ripples on the surface. When there's no ripples on the surface, you can see this beautiful reflection of the full moon. Today it's like a half moon. Well, maybe 2/3 of a moon. I remember seeing it as I walked in here. And as you see that beautiful moon in the heavens, it looks gorgeous. But you can only get a full, clear image of it, reflection of it, when the water is perfectly still. And the more still the water, the more accurate is the reflection. And when it's very, very still, and then you see such reflection. It was a Japanese saying, which I remember from my youth, that the only way to look at the full moon is reflected in a still mountain lake. And that's a good idea of what a Buddha is. A still mountain lake, which reflects perfectly the truth of things. And so that was just to a 5 or 6-year-old kid. But he got it close enough, and I did ask his mum to reinforce that. So the point is that for many people, we're not still enough. We're just always too active, always doing stuff. And the other nice thing about stillness, it brings you lots of happiness and joy. And all this other stuff which we do, like setting up Zoom meetings, we have to do that. But when it goes wrong, you know, it never actually does go wrong. That's the one nice thing which I've learned about, you know, being a Buddhist monk. Nothing ever goes wrong. It just challenges, it goes in a way we never expected. And you've all heard me before saying that, for goodness sake, when you have got some disease or some broken leg or whatever, and you go to the doctors, never say, there's something wrong with me, doctor. Please always say, there's something right with me. I'm sick again. Sickness is right. Don't stigmatize sickness. Don't stigmatize errors. Don't stigmatize when things go wrong. That's why I was almost brainwashed by my teacher Ajahn Chah when I was in Thailand. Every time something went wrong, we did something stupid, he would laugh his head off. And that's why he liked having lots of stupid Western monks around him, so that we could entertain him by lots of humor. And that's pretty true. So little by little, that we don't look at things like errors or things go wrong or difficulties as anything except different ways of looking at life. In other words, we don't have to overreact when things go wrong. The body can be sick, said the Buddha, but the mind, not sick, but just painful or doesn't do what you ask it to do, but the mind can always be really healthy. And that's one of the reasons why we meditate. Because when we meditate, we go past our bodies and go into our minds. And when we go into our mind, that sixth sense called the mind, then you get so peaceful, so beautiful, so wonderful in there. It's a delight, and it's a place where you can rest. It's like your holiday camp, which is one of the reasons why, you know, I dubbed this group Club Med many years ago, and that name has stuck, Club Meditation. And a Club Med, it means that it's a happy thing to do. It's a joyful thing to do. It's what you love doing. So little by little, we learn how to enjoy our meditation, which is one of the most important parts of it. Is when you sit down to meditate, you make sure you're in a comfortable position, in a place which is not too noisy, that you know that you've started with a bit of happiness and a bit of joy in your mind. Because when you have happiness and joy in the mind to begin with, that is actually a wonderful posture for your mind. We talk about postures for our body, how you should be sitting or whatever, but about how should the mind be set up before you start to meditate. It's joyful, happy, and just that joy and happiness takes you even further and even deeper. And you've known me for a long time, that I'm trying my very best to be joyful and happy, whatever I'm doing. Always tell lots and lots and lots and lots of silly jokes. And now I have to enjoy the silly jokes of my other monks who tell me lots of silly jokes. But it's very good rapport with people, because once you have a funny story, that does bring up a lot of happiness inside. And that happiness, you can close your eyes. It's like your mind is satisfied. It's not angry. It's not looking to find faults. It's looking to actually to enjoy the peace and happiness, which is the default state of the mind. So that is actually just the intro to the meditation. Now, usually, we start, in the old days anyway, at 7:30 to do an introduction to meditation, a guided meditation. And at 8 o'clock, we do a little talk or a little Q&A. Is that correct? Yeah, okay.
Yes, Ajahn, that's most definitely correct.
Very good. So you're very well trained, Chris. As I tell the monks, never argue with the boss if you want to get on in life.
Yes, I have been well trained.
Very good. Okay, so let's start a nice quiet meditation. And I will guide the first 20 minutes or so of it. And then afterwards, that we can just really get into it. A few people are just getting themselves all comfortable. So please do that. Okay, yeah. And if you need to move, just because I can see you all on the screens there, you can always like freeze the screen so it looks like you're meditating absolutely perfectly. And then you can go off and have a cup of tea or just check your emails or something. But I look at you and it looks like you're perfectly meditating. I think that's one of the reasons why I encourage the monks to wear masks, especially when they're in big, you know, the COVID masks, when they're in big meetings, because we can do all the chanting. And then if a monk doesn't know the chant, they've got the mask on, no one knows who's the monk who doesn't know the chant. They can get away with so much by hiding their mouth. But anyway, now we do some meditation. So if you get yourself in a good position, I'm sort of kind of cutting my top of my head off, so I'll just move my chair a little bit back. That's better. And again, I usually meditate on sitting on the ground, but I can't do that today. It doesn't matter. So if you now will just close your eyes. Then you bring the attention onto your body, first of all. You know, sometimes my body is like a friend which I exploit, I don't look after. And when I start meditating, I can find that my poor old body is saying, thank you so much for checking in on me. And I usually start by being really aware of my feet. And I start this because, again, my teacher Ajahn Chah would often say that I had stupid feet. It was really weird, but he saw all the band-aids I had to put on the feet because we were used to walk barefooted in the forest. A cut here, a bruise there. And he was right. My attention was in so many other things. And I neglected my feet. So now I can feel my feet. I'm barefoot now, but it's on carpet. And the carpet in this room just feels so nice, so not sensuous but comfortable. So I really get to be aware of the sensation of this carpet on my bare soles of the feet. And as I allow my mind to be still on that sensation, it becomes delightful. There's so much delight in the world which we miss when we don't stay and allow that feeling to delight us. It takes a few seconds, and after a while, I really enjoy something so simple as just the feeling of carpet on flesh. I just go through the rest of my feet, making sure everything is comfortable. The toes are not too close together, they're not squashed together. And sitting on a chair, I would often just move my legs out, move them back again to find the best position for them. Sometimes to notice the separation between the knees. Sometimes I need to close that up, sometimes to open it out. And I do that because the awareness will always notice which is the most comfortable. And sometimes it surprises me. But I'd use that trial and error together with mindfulness to find the best position for my knees. And then also, if ever you've played sport or you've had car, motorbike accidents or something and you've injured your knees, sometimes just focusing on that injury, just allowing it to be, not moving away from it. What happens if you usually stay with an object? You go inside of it. You go into it. You go closer into it. You focus in. It's not what you do, it's what happens. Once you focus in, you have so much kindness to this knee or other part of the body, which, you know, has served you for such a long time. You've got so much kindness to it. And after a while, the feeling of tension, ache, pain, throb, or whatever it is, tends to disappear. It's a wonderful thing to witness, because it shows you how this meditation can relax the body so much, the body's own energy flows can do a huge amount of healing. And then you go up from the knees, up the thighs, big muscles, making sure they're comfortable, to the butt. This is a simple body sweeping awareness and kindness method. And in the early days when I would meditate, sometimes I wouldn't really care too much about how my butt was situated, and I'd get my feelings in my legs would go to sleep, or the butt would hurt and I'd have to move. So I'd do that fidget straight away right now to make sure that the butt is as comfortable as can be. It still has feeling, you still know the sensations of the butt against the chair on which I'm sitting. But what happens is, because it's as comfortable as could be, soon those feelings, they disappear, they vanish. I care for the body and the body responds by caring for me, by letting me go somewhere else and focus deeply inside another part of the body or later on the mind. I go into my torso, first of all my back, and just making sure that's really comfy. And I got in the habit of doing a little stretching of the back, just to allow the back to feel good. And I stretch it and then let go. It gets like overly tight, first of all, and then I let go. And then it just goes into a much more relaxed posture than even when I started. When you push a ball up a hill and then you let it go, it falls down that hill and goes lower and lower and lower down. That's the relaxing of the muscles. And then I go inside the torso, the guts, colon, intestines, and all these other organs of my body, the stomach, feels good. The lungs, the heart, anything I can pick up. And as I sweep the attention up, if there is any place which is tight, tense, it's not usual. Again, I pause there. I don't judge. I don't try and wonder what it is. I just give it beautiful kindness. And sometimes it's like when you give animals kindness. They relax and don't harm you. They feel safe, you feel safe. So if you find any part of your body which is tight or tense, give it that kindness and that feeling of safety. It will relax, be at ease, and allow healing to happen. And I go up to my shoulders and make sure they're nicely relaxed and at ease. Sometimes people ask, how do you relax muscles? Awareness is first, so you're aware of what's happening, how the muscles feel. And then you do trial and error. Try this, try that, until you get how to relax. And you feel you're more relaxed. I go down my arms. I'm going to do this quite quickly because I never seem to have any injuries or pain or something in my arms. And then go to the hands, making sure every finger is comfortable. So don't have any theories, just ask your hands, are you comfortable? Do you need to move? Whatever the body suggests, follow that. And I go back up to my shoulders and neck, making sure I do. I've just got the habit of moving my head back and forth by this point to find the optimum position for my neck underneath my head. And I go to the front of the face. And on that face, all the muscles around the eyes and the nose and the mouth. I'm very aware of those. Because I know these muscles very well, after so many years of meditation, I know that today those muscles are a bit tight. Don't know why. So I'm now going to relax them. I can feel the muscles around my eyes getting looser. Where they were scrunched up tight like a sponge which has been squashed. Now that sponge is opening up and becoming light and airy. The mouth is okay. And when I relax the facial muscles, it also helps relax the cause of that tightness, which is usually some emotional difficulty, over-response. So it's a connection between the physical body and the mind. And sometimes if you live in and have very busy jobs, lots of decisions to make and thoughts and plans and stuff, sometimes imagine just between your ears and behind your eyes, your brain, just imagine there's this little blob of muscles. It overworks. So imagine just taking it out of your skull and putting it in a tiny bed, tucking it in a duvet, just have a nice pillow underneath it and say, brain, take a rest. Just that little visualization sometimes helps. Just so your overworked brain can take a few minutes of peace. But then before I let my body totally disappear from my awareness, I just notice the whole body sitting here. Sitting here as relaxed as I possibly can make it. And I know what happens next. I've done this so many times and it always occurs. Here it comes. The body feels delightful. It's a certain pleasure of relaxation. And that pleasure of relaxation, the pleasure of peace, is something which will take your meditation to such deep places. And I notice that the more I am aware of the pleasure of a relaxed body, the deeper that relaxation grows. The body feels great. Really at ease. Because this is a short guided meditation, I can't indulge too much. Usually I would indulge much longer. Now I just go on to the mind. How peaceful are you right now? If you gave a number to the degree of peacefulness you experience right now, 10 is very agitated, 1 is very peaceful. What number would you give yourself? It doesn't have to be accurate, it's just a skillful means to get in touch with that part of your mind which is peaceful or agitated. Once you know that, see if you can bring that number closer and closer to 1. Letting go of the past. I don't know what's happened to you. But mistakes are acceptable for you and others. So we forgive with kindness. It's easier to let go. Be kind to your past. And for your future, also be kind to it. The beautiful kindness, that warmth, opening the door of your heart to whatever happens, takes away so much tension and anxiety to the future. We can let that go too. We come to this beautiful experience called now. That's where peace lies. This is where your future is made, right now. So you open the door of your heart, your mind, everything now, to whatever is happening right now, to this very moment. But please add the kindness. Be kind to this moment, so you can relax, be at peace. And then soon this moment, just like the body before, felt delightful and relaxed. You're also relaxed in this moment. You're not holding it tight. That's very hard to stay in a place where you're so tight. It's like being in a prison. But here you're free. You stay in this moment because you're kind to it. And it's soft back to you. If you smile at somebody, they usually smile back. If I give kindness to this moment is kind back to me. And the next, I make sure I don't try and describe anything, or don't try and possess or control or own anything. I don't own my meditation. I'm a passenger, letting go in this moment, silent, and the meditation becomes still. Remember that little simile I said earlier about the lake. My mind is like the lake. I see how It can be without any waves or ripples or disturbances at all. I know its stillness. And I enjoy the feeling of stillness. The delights just being right here in a peaceful mind, not going anywhere, not trying to attain anything or get rid of things, just being here and being still. I will be quiet now for another 5 minutes or 6 or 7 minutes, and then when I ring the gong, it means the meditation is close to finishing. getting close to the end of the meditation now. How do you feel? What's it like inside, emotionally? You start to prepare to come out of the meditation. Start to feel the body. Relaxed. At peace. Oh, now ring the gong 3 times. When the gong finishes sounding for the 3rd time, it is a signal to come out from the meditation. There we go. Okay. So, just stretch any parts of the body if you need to. And then we can actually start the final half hour, which is usually some questions, if you have any questions. Or a subject for me to chat about. So, Chris, what should I do?
Right, I think probably people might like to ask some questions this evening. We seem to have a very mixed group from all over the world. Yes, I see Becky's got her hand up there.
Okay, Becky, yeah. Okay. Hi, Becky. You got your hand up? It's a question from you or from Suzu?
Hello, Becky. Would you like to unmute yourself? Okay, I think she's frozen there for the moment. So, Gloria, would you like to ask a question?
Yeah, I have some.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe I need that
question. Yeah.
Is it better? Is it better now?
Yes, I can hear you. Ho, ho. Oh, she's gone.
Becky, if you'd like to put your question in the chat, I could read it for our chat. Gloria, would you like to ask a question?
Hello, Ajahn. Thank you for your meditation. And the question I want to ask is that how to deal with angry person? Because I have this immense fear and anxiousness every time I have to deal with such a situation. And I really like, because I think if you are not relaxed enough, you cannot see things clearly.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's why I always try to like relax or calm down so that I can face the situation in a more objective way. But oftentimes, because I'm just too fearful and too anxious, I'm unable to do this. Do you have any advice for this? Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes the anger and fear are two different things, or anger and anxiety. Anger is about the past. You're angry about what that person did, or how you related to them, behaved to them. Remember, all the anger is about the past, and the past, you know, cannot be changed. That's why that, you know, in spirituality, religion, they had this word ineffable. It's supposed to describe ultimate reality as being ineffable. But I couldn't really find a good meaning for ineffable. So I changed the pronunciation to ineffable. You cannot change the past and say, if I did this, or if that happened to me, if I never met that person. The past is allows you to let it go. And sometimes the difficult experiences of the past, that's where we learn. the most difficult school teachers I had were the ones I hated, but I learned the most from. I was a schoolboy at that time. But then as a future, the future doesn't need to be limited by the past. So you don't need to have anxiety at all. And if it's some person who causes you a lot of difficulty, call them your teacher. That's why people I didn't like when I first became a monk in Thailand. It were the mosquitoes would drive me crazy. I don't know what the mosquitoes are like these days, but in those days they were sadistic. They wouldn't just bite you, they'd just go into your ear first of all, bzz, 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 bzz. So we'd just get it over and done with. Why are you telling me you're going to bite me? Just no, go for it and finish quickly. But when I complained to Ajahn Chah about that, he just said, the mosquitoes are your teacher. They're Ajahn mosquito. So whoever is that person in your life that causing you anxiety, call them your teachers. Ajahn boss at work. I don't know, Ajahn husband, Ajahn government or whatever. Whatever, call them your teachers and say thank you. When you change your attitude to them, the anxiety vanishes. And it's amazing that whenever you're kind to others, I mean really kind to others, they'll try and get angry at you to upset you, but they realise, you know, you can't be made upset. They leave you alone, you're no fun. They go and sort of make somebody else upset. And you're teaching them a really good lesson that just because of words or actions, this is what I'm learning from. I'm not going to get angry at you or be afraid. Don't let other people control you. Does that make any sense?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. Next question.
I think Becky, would you like to try again?
Yes, dear Ajahn, sorry, I better switch off my video because the line doesn't seem to be very stable. I would like to report a recent experience before I ask the questions. Recently, a friend of mine passed away because of the COVID.
Yes.
She is of my age group.
Yeah.
So she is one of my, the first one that passed away in my age group for how long I live, okay? Well, of course, she is not the first person that died in my eyes, but in my age group, she is the first one. And, and then I went to her funeral. During the funeral, the session of paying respect to say the last goodbye by circling the coffin, so I did. And when my mind have the contact with the first sight of her dead body, my mind have very strong reaction. So strong that want to turn away from looking. But out of respect, I have to finish the circling. So my eyes just blurring the image, actually. That's looking, seeing but not looking. So finish that. And after that, the mind is very disturbed, very disturbing. And then I just wait. I stand aside and then just wait what happened. And then there is a voice coming up in the mind. It say, that's not her. She is not in the body. And after that, there is another voice coming up. This is just nature unfolding the truth. This is Dharma, because everything arises, everything here, including our body, is subject to deterioration and death. So it's natural, it is nature. And then after hearing these two voices, my mind start having peace, not disturbed. And also I also have this vision coming up that one day I will be just like her, sleeping in the, not sleeping, lying in the coffin. And I say, I don't want to have the last respect from my friends. I don't want to scare them, because it's quite scary looking at that. And I don't understand at first, because this is not the first time I saw that body, because my parents died a long time ago. And also, you remember, even in Bodhiyana, I have attended the funeral of Greg. I remember when I saw Greg's body, my mind was not disturbed. I just see, I don't know, but when I saw my friend's body and her face, because her face is very, very different from what she was alive.
Yeah.
It's over. I can't express it. I don't want to tell you the detail, but it is just totally, totally different and have the impression of deterioration very strongly. So, after have that two voices coming up, so my mind was at peace. But then I have another query. This is my question, dear Ajahn. So it seems that there is some understanding coming up. So my mind was at peace. But I realized at the same time that it is not true realization. No, I should not use true. It is not realization yet. It is just, it's like when the mind has some trouble, or maybe the mind has something entangled, I'm not entangled, what the word should be. When the mind was disturbed, the mind will try to find something to resolve it. So if I think into my library, that some concept will come up to resolve the situation. So I just feel that these two voices are just concept at the moment. It's like putting a bandage to the wound, but it doesn't seem to be kind of realization. So this is what the question in my mind. So I would like to ask, how could I have the real realization of the Dharma instead of just conceptual understanding? And when there is realization, would there be any difference? How can we know the difference between realization and just a conceptual understanding? So this is my question.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And very good. That's wonderful. So it's a very good little lesson. It was painful at first, but you found a way through it. Actually, you didn't find the way through it. It's all the Dhamma you've heard over all these years, all the, as I call it, the brainwashing which I've given you and other monks have given you over those years, the nuns, they actually make you see things in a different way. It purifies your perceptions and conceptions, but when it comes down to realizations, it starts by changing the way you view things. You view things that, you know, that's the person's left the body, it's only your body left, the person is free now. And the idea of that view being purified first, and then that changes the way that you perceive things. So when somebody dies, you don't really perceive it as a great tragedy. I've done so many funeral services as a monk, and I don't perceive like how a person dies or at what age they die is really so important. But I always see how they lived. If they lived well, then I feel happy for them. If they lived even long, but they didn't live very well, their spiritual qualities weren't very developed, then I feel a bit sad. So you see things in a different way. So your views, they change your perceptions. And your perceptions change your thoughts. And the realizations can happen very slowly. But people notice them before you do. They say, you've changed, Becky. You're not the same as the one which they knew before. And sometimes that gives you a lot of encouragement. You're getting somewhere on this path. And that's what sort of realizations are like. They grow, they grow, they grow. Sometimes you feel you're going backwards, but you just need another refresher course.
Ajahn?
Yeah?
It seems that because the first eyesight coming in contact with the mind, there is no control. The mind just reacts in its own way, and that's why I have the doubt that it is not my realization yet. If I have realization, the mind would not be disturbed even at the first sight of the body, because this is how I think. I don't know if it is correct, because if once the realization has happened, it's already like a foundation there. Mm-hmm. So it would not be disturbed by the impression from the outside world. But then because my experience is, I was disturbed by the light, and then only afterwards, it is only afterwards there is the afterthought coming up. So I'm a bit confused. So I don't have that wisdom.
No, the wisdom is growing. Remember, even for the Buddha, had to see the old man, the sick man, the dying man, and then the holy man, to be able to become enlightened. That was just the great teaching that each one of us has to face. So you feel so very thankful. Remember, it's not that you become wise or you become enlightened. A much better way of looking at it is you're disappearing. You're vanishing, so you don't react to things because there's no one there to react. Someone criticizes you, but you're not a target because there's nothing to shoot at. And after a little while, when you disappear totally, just like an Ajahn Chah, his sense of ego and sense of self and what he thought he was would be able to vanish. So no one can criticize you. So as far as I'm concerned, it was a wonderful thing. You reacted well. At first, it was a challenge to you. A big problem, but you solved it well. So well done.
Well, thank you, Becky, and thank you, Ajahn. Sybil has a question for you, a request, Ajahn.
Yeah, certainly.
Dear Ajahn, is it possible for you to ask also the nuns to join this Armidale meditation group?
Yes, we've asked quite a few times. For the past, they have always been very busy, but they can't be as busy as I am. And we have a couple of nuns staying here now. That's Ayachanda and Ayaseri. But Ayaseri, you know, she spent such a long time looking after Ajahn Wayama before Ajahn Wayama passed away. So I offered this time to her for her to go on a retreat, and the same with Ajahn Chanda. She's starting a retreat, 6-month retreat for herself. And when nuns want to do that, yes, please, you know, go off on a retreat and enjoy a lot of peace and solitude. There are some nuns at Dhammasara who are starting to teach, but how to get them on board for Tuesday night, I'm not sure, but I will convey the message to them that those nuns at Dhammasara, they'd be very, very happy if you could teach at the Armidale group. They don't have to travel anyways, online.
Thank you, Ajahn. For your information, Sybil is in Germany.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Sorry.
From your home country, Yuli would like to also ask you a question. Yuli, are you okay there? Would you like to unmute? Would you like to ask a question or make a comment?
Yeah. I would like to also join Sybil. That would be very nice to have some nuns here as well. And my question would be, Ajahn Brahm, what is the age to ordain? Is there any age for men and for female?
You have to be at least 20 years old. And the Buddha was so kind, he said that's from conception. So he said put 6 months of the time in the womb. So 19 years and 6 months was the limit. But as for the age, at the moment when we're starting monasteries in Western countries, you're always a bit concerned that if all the monks get very old, or the nuns get very old, the younger nuns will spend all their time just looking after the other nuns, not having enough time to do their own meditation. So because of that, some monasteries have put limits into when you can, the elder limit before you can not be considered for ordination. But even so, those monasteries which do that, there's always exceptions to the rule. In other words, if there's somebody who's really cared for the monasteries in the past, they've looked after them, and you can't turn them away. I just can't do that. And especially when you look at the Vinaya, that's actually the rules we're all bound by as monks and nuns. They say the oldest case of a monk ordaining, he ordained in the time of the Buddha when he was 120 years old. 120. And after ordaining, he soon became a stream winner in 3 months, and he became fully enlightened, and then he passed away. He didn't actually complete a whole year as a monk, but it didn't really matter. He just got in there just at the last opportunity. So
we have some hope there.
yeah, you're not 120, yeah, are you?
That. No, because I give you the example, because I'm currently definitely thinking to go the monastic way. I already contacted Venerable Kanda, but I knew that she is currently over at your side. I was getting today the feedback from Chitters and Amaravati that they only take females up to 50, and I'm 55.
Yeah.
So I'm currently running out of options. I already sent a letter over to Ajahn Hasapana at your side as well. I'm just waiting for feedback. So this is currently where I am. I'm a little bit not disappointed. I don't know how I phrase it, but, you know, I'm ready now to go, but I can't find a place.
I love monastic life, as you all know. And so that you always want to try and do your best to make the opportunities available for people. And so if it is, you know, they're saying 50 now or 55 or 60 or whatever, I'm not sure, that will change. It's only just as you set up monasteries, it's a lot of hard work setting up a monastery. But then once it's set up, it becomes easier to actually to take people of all ages. And we have quite a lot of elderly monks in this monastery. Sometimes people call it an old age home for monks. But as this is not the Vinaya, this is the what we say, the monastic rules, and each community makes their own monastic rules. And I'm very happy that the very first monastic rule for Bodhinyana Monastery is like compassion, kindness. And that sort of overrides everything else. And that's what we're here for. That's what we teach, so can't we practice that? So sometimes you have these rules, but you know, if you do have these rules, if there's a good reason, sort of, you know, to bend them a little bit, then why not?
So you've still got plenty of time there, Yuri. So yeah. Thank you, Arjan, for your wisdom and kindness. Is there anyone else who would like to ask a question or make a comment? We still have 5 minutes left. It's a lovely opportunity if you would like to maybe share something of your personal meditation experiences or make a comment about Ajahn's talk before, or maybe ask another question.
Well, I just say one of the problems being the boss monk is that there's so many people coming to even the Bodhinyana Monastery. I counted how many people we're supposed to have for the rains here. That's a range retreat. And I counted like 30 monastics. 30.
Oh, goodness me.
Oh, that's huge.
John in Thailand would like to ask you something.
Okay, yes, certainly, yeah.
John.
Good evening, Arjan. It's nice to finally meet you. I've been following you on YouTube for quite some time and following your meditations. So that's wonderful.
My question is on
a somewhat practical level. I run a small charity.
Yeah.
And we never have enough money for anything that we need to do. Well, we get a fair amount of money, and we try very hard to find more and more money. And there's always so much work that we've got to do. But what happens is I often land up paying for projects overseas from my pension, and because I just want to see the work done.
Yeah, good.
And well, yeah, maybe good. It is good. But my big issue is that I'm running out of money, and I keep thinking it will be okay one day. I'm not quite sure how. And my wife says I'm an eternal optimist, so I just keep spending money on the basis that I hope that everything will be okay one day. But at the times I find this very disturbing, because I won't say panic, but I get quite worried, and this filters into my meditation practice, that I settle down, I get quiet. And then I start panicking about, well, how much money have I got left? How long is this going to last? Etc., etc., etc. And I have quite a challenge about whether I should pull rein back on what I do, or should continue in the event on the basis that it'll all be all right in the end somehow. But I don't know how. And how should I stop panicking myself? So it's a bit of a two-pronged question, really. Do I continue, and how do I stop? And if I do continue, how do I stop worrying so much about whether I'm going to go bankrupt or die destitute or have to come and knock on your door and say, can I stay at the monastery, please, or something?
Yeah. No, first of all, is when you have decisions to make, and they're very crucial decisions that I've learned over many years of practice, that if I think about it, I usually make stupid resolutions, stupid ideas. So instead of thinking about it, that I use the meditation as a way of solving problems. I just sit down, make the mind very peaceful and very still. And then so often, ideas come up, creative solutions, new ideas, ways of doing things. And those, sometimes I wonder, where on earth did it come from? An idea which just arises up by itself from stillness. And those are the ones I love to follow. Because I must say, I think most of the monks and you lot would agree, I've been quite a successful monk over all these years. And the way you do this is not by just thinking up or studying or asking other experts. You get as much information as you can, and then you sit down quietly, put aside all those thoughts from the past, be really peaceful and still. Then afterwards, just solutions, they pop up out of silence. And when those sorts of solutions pop up, they're brilliant. And I said, how on earth could I have thought of that? But it's the great solutions. And that's actually what I would suggest to you, because you know, compassion is marvelous, but it's also compassion goes to you. You're another being in this world. May all beings be happy and well, be at peace. And you're counted in there. So you have to look after yourself. But sometimes we can make mistakes. Sometimes it doesn't really work out the way we expected. It's usually life is much, much better than we expect. Much more interesting. So still be kind. Honestly, that's one of the best ways of using money, is actually giving it to someone else and just seeing them, you know, start crying or have some food to eat or something. And we're supposed to be so poor as monks, penniless, homeless, but sometimes you see the donations which come in and it allows us to do groups like the Armadale group and oh, goodness knows what else. People are so kind. That's what I've found. But you know, you have to get out there and just do a bit of, not advertising, but just let people know what you're up to. And when they do, they're more than happy to help out.
Well, I certainly hope that a few more people, I find that people, they're very, your experience I think is maybe different from mine, but I certainly find that people, they think it's wonderful work that I do at times, but then that's as far as it goes.
Yeah, it's strange because you get people on board and get them to help out, and just it's not just wonderful work, it's just, look, the Armadale meditation group here, I was just mentioning it to someone, I think today, every year you do a little collection to get these gift cards from Coles Myers or somewhere, and was it $25 or something, and you give them out to children in the women's refuges here. So you don't give it to the refuge, you don't give it to the mum, you give it to the kids, so the kids can go up and buy themselves some presents for Christmas time. This is Armadale Buddhist meditation group. It doesn't really matter who you are, but understanding, it's not just getting a gift, but giving a gift of like freedom, and these little kids being in power of, you know, what they can actually buy, what they can't buy. It's a wonderful thing to do. And you mention that a few times and you get, you can't say too many, but you get a whole heap. How many did we get last time for when we did that collection? Huge amount of these cards. Just need to touch people's hearts. You touch people's hearts and then just, there's a lot, basically there's a lot of money in the world today, but people don't know how to make use of it. And just spend sort of, you know, $10 and see a beautiful smiling kid makes it Christmas for them. People still care. And when I was a layperson, I had money, you just please take as much as you can. And because it's a privilege to give, to share, to donate.